Welcome to our last presentation of Chapter 5, Introduction to Stocks. And in this last presentation, we will take a look at some types of common stocks, and then take a look at market capitalization, which is a fancy term for how big is your company you're looking at, and end with some stock strategies for investing. So let's get started on slide 75. Now, in this discussion of types of common stocks, much of this was taken, paraphrased, if you will, from the first book on the in the bibliography, which is on the class websites in Chapter 1 and Chapter 5, and that's called One Up on Wall Street, from the famed investor Peter Lynch. And there's an old saying, if you're going to steal, steal from the best. So thank you, Mr. Lynch. You're going to read One Up on Wall Street. Eventually, maybe not right now, but you're going to read One Up on Wall Street, aren't you? Yes, you are. Thank you. Nod your heads. Yes, yes. It's fun. It's fun. He's funny. He's down to earth. He's good. Okay, slide 75, blue chip stocks, blue chips. These are financially strong, high-quality stocks with long and stable records of earnings and dividends. Peter Lynch calls them the stalwarts. They are often referred to as value stocks. They tend to attract conservative stock investors. And this has nothing to do with politics, folks. We're not talking about politics. We're talking about people who are afraid of losing money. Because will these stocks make you rich overnight? No, no. Will they make you rich over time? Well, if the economy continues to grow worldwide, and these companies tend to have global footprints, which means they have operations more than just in the United States, then you should do well. And let's take a look at some examples. General Electric, General Motors. Well, General Electric, folks, the venerable General Electric, the only company that was in the original Dow Jones Industrial Average of 1896, I think. That's still in the in the index. Well, what happened? Well, in the financial turmoil, they got hammered. Why? Because when you think of General Electric, you think of electrical devices and power plants and locomotive engines, and they build jet engines, and they do a lot of medical devices too. But over in 2007, right before the turmoil, well, more than half of their revenue and profits were coming from their financial operations. They're a huge financial institution. And so they were hit hard. But they're coming back strong, folks. They're coming back strong. And I take a good look. We'll take a look at General Electric a little later on in Chapter 6. And what about General Motors? Well, it depends on which one you're talking about, doesn't it? Right. The old GM, which is gone, or the new GM, which is seems to be holding up pretty well, folks. But sure, you know who these companies are. They're the brand name companies that everybody can name, and everybody has heard of. Companies that are based all around the world now. The blue chips, the McDonald's of the world, and the Procter and Gamble's, and the Coca-Cola's. Income stocks. These are stocks with long and sustained records of paying higher than average dividends. Careful, these are also often referred to as value stocks. These are normally, but not always, slow growth companies in mature industries. So some poster children, if you were, utilities. Exactly. Are utilities growing quickly? Well, maybe if the area they are based in is growing quickly, but no. Utilities normally, they continue day after day, year after year, producing the electricity and the gas and the oil or whatever it needs to get out to the companies and the businesses and the the apartments and homes that need their service. Exactly. Are people going to start taking cold showers in the dark? No. So is SDG&E going to be? Yes. But are they going to explode on the upside? Are they going to make you rich instant? No, not quickly, but over time, yeah. How about banks? Well, for decades, banks were boring, stodgy, old, venerable companies that paid dividends consistently, and then they started to get tricky as banking was deregulated over the last 30 years. It really took its took a giant leap, some would say forward, others would say backwards, when the Glass-Steagall Act that was put in place during the Depression was overturned or repealed in 1999. And there are many, yours truly included, who are saying, we have to bring this darn thing back. And the banks, no, they don't want to bring it back. That means they would have to be responsible. Anyway, so those are the income stocks. Slide number 76, growth stocks. All right, growth stocks are the stars. They're the ones on the cover of GQ and Vogue and People magazine. They've got the good hair and their teeth are shiny and they've got abs and pecs and, oh yeah, they're the good look. The glamorous stocks. These are stocks that experience high rates of growth in operations and earnings. The growth rate is typically 15 to 20% or higher, which may not sound like a lot, folks, but if you were growing at 20% in 3 years, you'd be twice the weight you are now. Mm-hmm. They're often associated with high PE ratios. Remember, price divided by earnings. Often no dividends at all, or just a very small token amount. Why? Because most of the profits are being reinvested back into the company. The stock price should go up because the company is growing, but we often associate that growth stock with volatility, which means at the slightest hint that their growth stops or slows, the stock price gets hammered. So you if you're going to invest in growth stocks, you better be careful because these things can be very volatile. And let's take a look at some examples. Intel, Microsoft, wait a minute. Are Intel, Microsoft, and Dell still growth stocks? Not as they were 20 years ago. No. They've become blue chip stocks, right? They've become giants that grow slowly now with the rest of the industry. In fact, Dell, what's going on with Dell? PC sales have actually declined. Yeah, right. Intel, Microsoft, and Dell are looking at Apple and Samsung and Nexus from Google and saying, hey guys, you know, tablets are nice, but they're not going to replace PCs, are they? Anyway, who are the growth stocks now? Right, the Googles of the world. Apple is growing quite a bit. Fleecebook. Armbook. But anyway, that social disease networking company that people spend half their lives on. I don't got time for that, folks. I got too much on my important things to do, like prepare for classes and grade. Anyway, so those are the companies that are in the news. Those are the companies that are growing fast. And if you're into mathematics, you may have heard of the first derivative, also called velocity. Yeah, well, some of these investors, they don't look at how fast it's growing. They look at the second derivative, sometimes called acceleration. How fast the growth is accelerating. How fast the growth is growing. And if that puts you in a tailspin, just forget about it. But anyway, they look at how fast the growth is going. And if the growth slows down, many of these growth investors will dump the stock and the stock will plummet quickly. Yeah. Okay. Slide number 77. Now, here's something I want you to read 1, 2, 3 times. Growth versus value. The investment world loves to use the terms growth and value. You will hear people discuss investments, especially stocks, and talk about growth and value. But be careful. The meanings of the terms are not exact. It depends on who you're talking to. Typically, investors often use growth to designate a high PE stock, while they use value to denote a low PE stock. But that's not the way I use the term value. I use the term value the way most people think of it when they're shopping for things or comparing items, is something of good value to me. And so what I find and what you will find is a high PE stock might be a great value, while a low PE stock might not be a good value in the sense of the term of whether or not there's some worth there, if you know what I'm discussing. You can go back and make sure you do, because you're going to find investors use the term value for a low PE stock. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the low PE stock is a good value. And here's a phenomenal example on slide 77. In January of 2005, Google was selling for around $200. It had gone public in August of 2004, and it had a sky-high PE. I think it was 67. While the old GM was selling for $34 with a very low PE and very generous dividends. I forget exactly what they were paying, but it was like 7 or 8% in dividends. But that was then. Today, Google sells for around $750 with, by the way, a much lower PE, and the old GM stock is gone. They changed the name to, and you can't make this stuff up, Motors Liquidation. I guess they didn't want to call it Liquidation Motors. I don't know. General Motors, Liquidation Motors. And it last sold for 4 cents in March of 2011 and is now worthless. Right. The GM that we talk about now is a different company. And if you own the GM stock in 2005 and held on to it, it eventually sold for 4 cents and then stopped selling. Okay. Now, my question to you is, which one was the better value? Right? I would submit to you that the better value was Google, obviously, even though it had a high PE, and the worst value, the horrible value, was GM, even though it had a low PE. So be careful when you discuss growth and value with other investors. Be careful about what they are saying and what you're saying. Slide number 78, cyclical stocks. Cyclical, what does that mean? Well, folks, it means that these stocks, their earnings and their overall market performance are closely linked to the general state of the economy. They will tend to follow the business cycle of advances and declines. And the poster child, the archetypal example for this, is automobiles. The automobile companies are very, very cyclical. Why? Because when the economy is doing well, people are getting new jobs, they're getting raises, they go out and buy a car. They're optimistic. What's wrong with the old car? I don't know. I want a new car. And when, right, the economy doesn't do well, people are getting laid off, do they go out and buy new cars? No, no. Old Bessie out in the driveway is doing just fine. Thank you very much. And the same thing is true for any companies that make stuff, materials like timber, steel, chemicals, anything that is used to make things tends to be cyclical and does well when the economy does well and does poorly when the economy does poorly. And so if you watch the price of these companies, you will see them get hammered during recessions and then do really well during expansions in the economy. Now, on the other side of the coin here are defensive stocks. These are stocks that tend to hold their own, and they may even do well when the economy starts to falter. Well, why is that? Right, people running out of the cyclicals and moving to the defensive stocks. They remain stable during declines in the market. and they're often, but not always, associated with income stocks. Now, what kind of companies would do well when the economy starts to falter? Food companies, right? Basic consumer staples, and that's what Kellogg's is, a food company. Do you eat more cornflakes or Cheerios because the economy's doing well? Do you eat fewer meals when the economy, well, maybe a little bit, but not a whole lot. Procter & Gamble makes Tide and Pampers and Gillette shaving materials. Exactly. Toilet paper. And drug companies tend to be defensive. Why? Because you need your drugs. You need your insulin. You need your beta blockers, or you need your statins. Even if the economy does poorly, you still got to take your drugs. And those are defensive stocks. When the economy expands, yeah, they don't explode. But when the economy does poorly, they tend to hold their own. In fact, they may even do well. Ironically, because people are, hey, I need to be defensive. Slide number 79. Now we get into some stocks that are a little bit harder to identify often, such as turnarounds. I like to use the word goner because often they just don't turn around. A company that has fallen on hard times, and what you as a potential investor have to think and determine is there potential for a rebound. Many of you weren't born at the time, weren't alive, but in the early 80s, Chrysler almost disappeared. They made some very bad decisions in the 70s, horrible decisions. Some of the cars they built were just terrible, and they almost disappeared. A gentleman by the name of Lee Iacocca, who used to work at Ford, in fact, he was responsible for he worked on the project that created the Ford Mustang in the 60s, took on the job of turning around Chrysler. And he actually did a very good job, folks. The stock price went down to $3. I think it hit the $3. And then 3 years later, it was up to 40 or so. So he did a very good job. And now Ford and GM and Chrysler are trying to turn themselves around. Will they be successful? Well, that's still, it's still the jury's out, but it looks as though they're hanging in there. GM's doing very well in China, believe it or not. They sell more Buicks in China than they sell in the United States. How about other turnaround companies like Kodak? Yeah. It's so ironic. Who developed the digital camera? Kodak did. And then did not want it to do well. Why? Because that meant that they didn't sell as much film and they, yeah. Okay. So these turnaround stocks often don't turn around. How about asset play stocks? Excuse me. Well, these are a little harder to figure out. You have to do some serious research and know the industry. These are companies that are sitting on assets that could be sold or spun off. And what you have to do is you have to dig deep and see, you know, what's behind the face, the normal face that everyone sees of the company. JCPenney's is a good example. The department store business is very tough these days, folks. Many of them are gone. The Broadway, Montgomery Ward, Mervyn's, Robinson's, May, and then they got together and became Robinson's May, and they're both gone, and who else? Just several of them. What's happening is they're getting hit from the bottom by the Walmarts and the Targets of the world, and they're getting hit from the top by the boutique shops of the world and the needless markups and the Nordstroms. And so JCPenney's was in trouble. This was about 10, 12 years ago. They were, you know, hit on hard times, as were the rest of them. But they have a insurance division, an insurance division which is actually very profitable, that they could easily have sold to raise cash to have kept the company afloat. So people, if you knew that, you could have said, oh, okay, I know JCPenney's is going to be hit like the rest of them, but they have some assets that could keep them afloat. What's going on with JCPenney's now is they have a new CEO who's made a bold decision to change their business model, and it doesn't seem to have been working very well for them, but we'll see. We'll see. The jury, as they say, is still out. Another very interesting asset play that you may, I hope, maybe you'll be interested in is Pepsi. I want you to take a look at Pepsi, if you have the time, and try to see what their major asset hiding behind their public face is. It's very interesting, folks, very interesting. People think that Coke and Pepsi are competitors, and in some ways they are, but in another very, very striking way, they are not competitors. So if you're piqued, your interest is piqued while you're doing this research on the companies I ask you to look at in Chapter 5, check out Pepsi for their asset. Now, how about penny stocks? Oh, boy, folks. We've made a little reference to these. Let's just stay on the OTC bulletin boards and the OTC pink sheets. Just stay away from these things. If anybody tries to get you involved in penny stocks, just tell them to walk away. Just walk away, because they are scams for the most part. Now, there's some companies that really are hurting. They've hit on hard times, or they've never been able to get the pig to fly, as they say, to get this thing off the ground and get it to fly. But for the most part, they're just scams. And there's some examples on the class website that I want you to take a look at. We would look at now in the face-to-face class. And there are literally thousands, maybe 20-some thousand of these things. Yeah, so just don't get sucked in, all right? Sure, it might go from 3 cents to 6 cents, and you double your money in 3 days. But then it'll promptly go to 0.0006 cents, and you've lost everything. Anyway, and also I want you to take a look at the Casas de Cambio presentation, where you have to see the spread. The spread on these penny stocks is outrageous. So stay away from these things. Slide number 80, foreign stocks, sometimes called international stocks. Well, it used to be that directly investing in these was difficult, sometimes impossible for the average investor. But not anymore. Many brokerages now offer international, global, if you will, brokerage accounts, where you can buy and sell securities, stocks, other securities, also bonds, on any or many of the major stock exchanges around the world. And to do that, you have to remember that you're going to have to change your dollars into, yen, or into euros, or into pesos, or whichever currency the exchange works in. To get around that, for many decades, some of the largest companies in the world would have what are called ADRs, American Depository Receipts. And I've seen GDRs, which stands for Global Depository Receipts. I have also seen those. But what is an American Depository Receipt? Well, it's usually a huge bank or trust company, a very large financial institution, which will go over to Japan and buy a ton of Sony stock or Toyota stock. And they'll bring it to the United States, and then they will reissue it dollar denominated. They will reissue it in dollars. So they call them American Depository Receipts. And that was the way most people would invest in international, outside the country, stocks. But not anymore. As we said, you can get a global brokerage account. And the problem is you have to buy and sell the currencies. And that gets tricky, as we'll see in just a minute. The way most of us little people invest in foreign stocks, international stocks, are through global and international mutual funds. And remember the distinction. Global means everybody, including the United States. International means everybody outside the United States, except for the United States, ex-USA. Now, we discussed this a bit before, but let's do it again. Currency. When you move your money from dollars to another currency, you have to be aware of the currency effect, the currency issues. And it's a counterintuitive relationship. A stronger dollar has a negative impact on you as a U.S. investor when you invest in foreign markets. So if you move your money into pesos, Mexican pesos, and then the dollar goes up, all other things being equal, and of course they never are, your investment in pesos will now have gone down because now it takes more pesos to bring those pesos back to dollars. If the dollar goes down, it has a positive impact on your investment. Do you understand? It's a seesaw, and we'll come back to this idea of seesaws when we get to bonds. The dollar goes up, your investment goes down. The dollar goes down, your investment goes up. Again, ignoring everything else that's going on. And you can't do that, of course, but just that's how it works. And the question you have when you go move your money outside the United States is, what do you think is going to happen? Will the dollar be stronger or weaker in the coming years? Now, there are many people who are jumping up and down screaming that the dollar is going to become worthless. They say it's already, I love the people who say it's already worthless. And they say, yeah, our dollars are worth nothing. Those bums in Washington, they've destroyed the dollar. I say, oh, you think it's worthless? Fine, here's what I'm going to do. I'll give you this bag. Here, I'll give it to you. All you do now is you go to the bank and take out all those worthless dollars and you bring them back and give them to me and I'll take all those worthless dollars off your hands and I'll even buy you lunch. How's that for a deal? I tend to believe, for what it's worth, folks, I tend to believe that the dollar will be weaker over the next coming years. Why? Because we continue to import more than we export, specifically oil. But we have been increasing our oil production. We've also been working to reduce our oil consumption, not as much as we need to, as in my humble opinion. But it's not as though the dollar is going to collapse, folks. The United States is still the largest economy. Someday we'll be passed by China, but that makes sense. There's four times as many Chinese as there are Americans, so it just makes sense that their economy is going to be larger. And eventually India's economy is going to be larger. Why? Because there's four times as many Indians as there are Americans. But in terms of the United States, yes, our reports of our imminent demise, I believe, have been vastly over-exaggerated, as Mr. Mark Twain would say. So remember the relationship of the dollar versus outside currencies. Now, so you got that with those types? There's a worksheet that asks you about the different types of stocks, and also on the assignment sheet, I ask you to determine what type of stock the stock I ask you to look up, ask you to research is. And remember that sometimes stocks might fit in one or two different categories or three different categories, and sometimes they don't fit in any category. Some of them are just kind of strange, don't fit in any category. Because now on slide 81, we're going to turn our attention to capitalization. We've been using this term often, and now let's finally define it. Capitalization is a fancy word for how big is the company. It's an easy calculation, but people have a hard time with it, folks. You just take the current price of the stock and you multiply it times the number of shares outstanding. You see, the stock price itself, it is meaningless. It really is, unless you know how many shares are out there. Then you know how much the company is worth. And we'll take a look at some examples in just in a minute or so. But first, let's categorize them. Well, there are three basic categories. And you can think of them as the Papa Bears, the Mama Bears, and the Baby Bears. It's that simple. The Papa Bears are the large cap stocks, large capitalization stocks. And these are generally considered companies that are worth $10 billion and up. Now, you are going to hear people use the term mega cap. That's a subcategory of large cap. And I wish you would remember that in this class. It's a good idea to do. But if you don't worry about it. Those are companies that are above $100 billion of market capitalization. Those are the huge mega cap stocks such as Apple and Exxon, GE and Walmart. The mid-cap stocks, many of these you've heard of, many of them you haven't, and they're companies that are about $1 or $2 billion up to about $10 billion of capitalization. They're the mama bears. And then the baby bears are the small cap stocks. Those are companies about 100 million or so up to 1 or 2 billion. Not 10, I'm sorry, that's not right. 1 or 2 billion. It depends on who you talk to. Some people make the cutoff at 1 billion. Some people make the cutoff at 2 billion. But still, those are small companies. And you may have heard of a few of them, but most of these companies you would not have heard of. There's a subcategory of small cap stocks called micro cap, and they're under 100 million, anywhere from 10 to 50, $75 million. Those are called micro cap stocks. If you remember that term, great. If you don't, it's okay. Make sure you know large cap, mid cap, small cap, and if you remember mega cap, greater than 100 billion is a subset, a subcategory of large cap. Less than 100 million, micro cap, a subcategory of small cap. And we have to mention again, even though we shouldn't, in polite company, mention the penny stocks. Just stay away, folks. And in the industry, anything less than about $5 a share is often considered a penny stock. But I don't really like that definition. To me, it's a lot like hanky panky. You know something is bad when you see it. I mean, some very good companies are priced under $5, and it's not because they're scams or anything. But you can almost just smell it coming at you. The first thing is, are they on the OTC bulletin board or on the pink sheets? That's the first bad sign, right? Is it a real company, or is it just somebody's garage in Idaho or Iowa or one of those places that starts with the letter I? You can smell these things coming at you. And they tell you, oh yeah, we got this new product. It's called a bacon stretcher. It's going to be revolutionary. It's going to do a whole lot better than last year's Blue Steam, which didn't do too well. But this one's going to be a winner. Right, okay, fine. Okay, so remember these? There's a worksheet I want you to work on, worksheet number 3, that discusses and gets you to do capitalization. So let's take a look at slide 82 where we do an example. Remember our stock, $20 stock? Right. Well, how about if the number of shares were 5 million? We would take $20 times 5 million shares, and sometimes that multiply sign looks funny on other people's computers. My apologies. But the multiply sign is supposed to be an X. Sometimes it comes up as in the computers at Southwestern, it comes up in the classroom as a Christian cross. And I was like, I'm not trying to indoctrinate anybody, folks. It's just the font. So $20 times 5 million is $100 million of market capitalization. So this company is a small cap stock. Remember this, the stock price is, for the most part, until you get into the penny world, irrelevant. You must look at the market capitalization to see what the value of the company is. Remember Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway? Right, exactly. Sure, the stock price was $145,000, but there aren't as many shares out there because he never split the stock. Got it. Okay, so make sure you can do those problems on worksheet number 3, because they may, just may be on the exam. And remember, do you really have to, no, you don't really have to do them. You just go on the Yahoo or Bloomberg or MarketWatch website and they'll tell you what the capitalization is. Slide number 83. So let's take a look at some examples of real companies. You've heard of Walmart, you've heard of Target, right? And you may notice that they used to use a star wall, star mart, then they used a minus sign or a dash, something like that. Now they seem to have taken it away, so I'm trying to stay with them as best I can. So Walmart versus Target. So you look at the price alone, and you see that Walmart is $71.48, and you see that Target is $62.49, and this is as of February 8th, and you, 2013, right? And you say, well, they're probably about the same price in terms of capitalization, right? They're about the same, they're worth about the same. Now, wait a minute. Intuitively, who do you think is a whole lot larger? Which company, right? You know that Walmart's a whole lot larger than Target, right? But you don't know how much until you look at the number of shares outstanding. And it turns out that Walmart has 3.35 billion shares being traded out in the world, and Target only has 650 million, almost 651 million. So the market capitalization is vastly different, right? Walmart is worth almost, as of February 8th, almost $240 million, folks. Whereas Target's worth about $40.5 billion. Did I say million? I apologize. $240 billion, and Target's worth about $40.5 billion. So it turns out that Target is about one sixth the size. Walmart's about six times bigger than Target. Right, you knew that intuitively. Maybe you didn't think it was that big a difference, but it is. And one of the reasons, well, Target's still fairly a United States company. It has not really gone global yet. Well, Walmart has, and with some success in some areas and some problems in other areas, but they want to be the world's, and they're working toward it. Slide number, so you understand that? You got to look at market capitalization. So they're both large cap companies, aren't they? But Walmart is now in that rarefied air where it's considered what's called a mega cap stock. Exactly. Slide number 84. How about AT&T and Verizon, the duopoly, the former baby bells which have come to dominate the telecommunications landscape in the United States? Well, you look at the price of AT&T, $35.27, and you look at the price of Verizon, $44, and you might think, well, wait a minute. Is Verizon bigger than AT&T? Well, again, we got to look at the outstanding shares, and it turns out that there's 5.58 billion, 5.5 billion shares of AT&T, 2.86 billion shares of Verizon. So it turns out that AT&T is quite a bit larger than Verizon, $197 billion as of February 8th. Whereas Verizon is almost $127 billion. They're both large cap, both mega cap stocks, but AT&T is quite a bit larger, bet 50% larger than Verizon. Make sense? Okay, so now what does this mean, folks? Well, it means if you wanted to buy AT&T, if you had the hankering to own the company AT&T, you'd have to come up with $196.84 billion to buy up all, wait a minute, would that work? That, no, it wouldn't work, would it? Because as soon as you started buying all the shares that were offered for price, for at the prices that they were at, as soon as you start cornering the market, so to speak, and buying every time somebody put a bid out for an asking price, you would take it. The price would start rising, and it would just become mayhem. And for this reason, when one company or an individual or a group of investors want to take over another company, there's a set methodology where the individuals will go to the exchange, the New York Stock Exchange, the Amex, well, not the NYSE Market or whatever it's called, MKT or MKT, and then the NASDAQ, and we're staying away from the pink sheets and the bulletin board. They will go to the New York Stock Exchange and say, hey, look, we have a tender offer. We have an offer to buy AT&T. And what they will do is they will typically price the stock 10%, 20% higher. So you'd have to come up with about $220 billion or $240 billion. And there's a set methodology for bringing this information public, because as soon as it becomes public, if investors believe it is a real offer, a bona fide, a serious offer, what will happen to the price? Immediately it will jump to the tender offer price. And so that's called insider information, folks. Do you think you can trade on that information? If you know that your company is going to buy another company, can you go, no, that's not legal, don't do it. Right, and that's where the SEC tries to catch the bad guys who'd pull this kind of stuff off. If the investment community thinks that they're just blowing smoke, they're not going to be able to do it, then the price may jump a little bit. Sometimes the investment community says, ooh, there might be a bidding war for this company. So they might even raise the price higher. They might even bid up the price higher than what the tender offer is, assuming that somebody else is going to jump into the fray. So it gets very complicated, jousting, so to speak. Remember Mr. Merriweather? Merriweather? Yes, exactly. But is anybody going to buy AT&T? No one's going to come up with $220 billion to buy AT&T. Man, it's not going to happen. Slide number 85. So let us finish our discussion with a discussion of different investment strategies. There are many more than what we're discussing, obviously, but these are some of the tried and true ones. And slide 85 shows you my personal favorite. So I tell you my biases right up front, folks, so you know where I'm coming from. And I'll tell you what other people say about other things. And yeah, but this is my favorite. It's called buy and hold. You use fundamental analysis. Now, what's that? We'll describe it in chapter 6 in more detail. To identify high-quality companies with good growth prospects and the potential for dividends at reasonable prices. It's sometimes called value investing. It's sometimes called growth at a reasonable price investing, called GARP. I like that, GARP. The World According to GARP is a great book. Read it. And you hold it forever. Huh? Well, they once asked Mr. Buffett, well, Mr. Buffett, how long ideally should you hold the stock? Hold it forever. Now, he wasn't being serious, right? Maybe he was, because he's holding them forever. He's certainly not selling his stocks. He's going to give away most of his fortune. But yes, as Mr. Bogle said in the interview I hope you watched from chapter 1, you basically take advantage of the benefits that our system of capitalism have produced over eons, and you hold on to it forever. And you know, you obviously start selling things as you need to in retirement and the like, or who knows, you might be so wealthy you can donate them to your favorite charity, because you certainly don't want the little jerks. I mean, your little sweet children, cherubims, to get it, do you? Well, there's a great piece on the website I want you to look at called Don't Lose Perspective. It really shows you, I think, very vividly how difficult it is to try to time the market. Because in any given month or week or year, you just never know what's going to happen. But if you take a long-term perspective, you'll find that providing the whole thing doesn't crash and fall apart, crack into 1,000 pieces, we should do all right. So check out the Don't Lose Perspective presentation on the class website. Another strategy, which is very favorite of mine, called income strategy, also called equity income. Remember the equity income mutual funds? This strategy emphasizes dividends over capital appreciation. Ideally, you are looking for companies that are growing their dividends, because as we noted beforehand, companies that pay consistently growing dividends tend to do well when the market as a whole does poorly, sometimes called defensive stocks, right? In general, these are appropriate for conservative stock investors. Again, nothing to do with politics. And this strategy works, hand in glove, as they say, works very well with dividend reinvestment plans, DRIPs. How do we make money in stocks over the long term, especially when the market's just doing nothing, going up, going down, not going anywhere? We concentrate on the additional shares that our dividends are purchasing. Stocks which have had histories of consistent dividend increases have often been the market's best long-term investments. And we'll take a look at some of these in Chapter 6, some of these companies that have been consistently rising their dividends over time. Slide number 87, growth strategy. This is the one that many people believe is the best one, and you decide. You, as a growth strategy investor are investing in stocks with above average forecasts of earnings growth. Dividends are normally a secondary or of no concern. They usually have high PE ratios, price to earnings ratios. Why? In expectation of higher earnings in the future. And as we said, the growth stocks are the stars. They're the ones with the very white teeth, and their pictures have all been photoshopped, and they have the six-pack abs. Everyone wants to jump on the bandwagon as a company is experiencing strong growth. Subsequently, the stock price is often bid up to very high levels, very high valuations, and typically these are also the stocks that are the riskiest. When the slightest hint of a slowdown in the growth appears, the stock price is often brutally punished. In other words, the second derivative, the acceleration, not the velocity. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, don't worry about it. Go talk to somebody who's taking calculus, okay? Slide number 88, aggressive growth strategy, sometimes called speculation or short-term trading. The investor aggressively trades in and out of stocks in order to achieve eye-catching returns. They don't want to own stocks. They want to rent them. Instead of waiting 3 to 5 years for a stock to move, an aggressive stock trader would go after the same investment return in 6 months to a year or less. Some traders have time horizons in the weeks or days. And now, folks, there are companies who are using computers to make millions of trades per day. I have a very difficult time understanding why this is allowed. You and I cannot do this. Why? Because we would be eaten alive by transaction costs. Why are these companies allowed to make millions of transactions per day, assuming, I mean, obviously, if they're paying $7 a trade, millions of trades per day, that's, geez, they're not paying that. And why aren't they paying it? I don't know. I can't get a straight answer from people because they don't know. And you read the stuff on the internet and the people writing it, you can tell they don't understand it either. There's a book called Dark Pools from one of the best writers in New York, and I have to get a hold of that and read it because it talks about these people who are doing these million trades per day, and I got to understand this. The aggressive growth strategy, the speculation, the short-term trading, this is the strategy that many people think they are supposed to use when they start investing in stocks. Okay, I got $10,000, I'm going to start buying and selling stocks, and this guy on the TV and on the internet is going to show me how to do it. It is fraught with perils and drawbacks, not the least of which are the serious transaction costs that can be generated as a result of frequent trading. If you're a stockbroker, oh boy, you simply adore suckers. I mean traders, speculators who use this strategy. Why? Because they're generating huge commissions for you. So, are you going to try this strategy? By all means, go right ahead. But I'll tell you up front, it ain't easy. It is very difficult, and don't be surprised when you become ill to your stomach, because that's what people often they complain about. This is making me sick. It's making me ill. Slide 89, contrarian strategy. Okay, here's something that's pretty interesting. Let's take a look at this. Contrarians are strategists, stock strategists, that invest in stocks that are out of favor with the market for some reason, as reflected by low price-to-earnings ratios and low prices compared to their fundamentals. And we'll discuss the fundamentals in Chapter 6. Contrarian investors actively seek stocks from companies with sound financial statements that the market has undervalued. And here's a great quote from an old contrarian. I always try to be accommodating. I buy when others want to sell, and I sell when others want to buy. Yeah, because we're humans. We want to go with the crowd. And yet, even though that helped us 100,000 years ago, stay alive, because when everybody was running a certain way, you ran that way because you didn't want to be eaten by the tiger. Now, in the world of finance, it ain't always the best thing to do. However, being a contrarian is very difficult, since historically the market rises about three times as often as it falls. Now, that's not a guarantee, folks. It's not going to go one, two, three, down, one, two, three. It doesn't work that way. So you have to be prepared to sit on your hands. And here's one quote that I really like from a well-known contrarian. It's not a steady business. Howard Marks, the CEO of Oak Tree Capital, when asked about what it was like to be a contrarian. In other words, you have to be willing to wait until 2008 comes along and then dive in and buy with both fists everything you can get your hands on, and then wait for it to come back, and then wait till everybody's giddy and happy and partying, and then you sell. And Warren Buffett is a wonderful example of a contrarian investor. He, in 2008, when the organic matter hit the ventilating device, and people thought it's the end of the world, and stay out of stocks. I remember the very famous guy, I forget his name, Jim Cramer. He was saying, stay away from stocks for 5 years. Don't touch stocks for 5 years. He's telling his people. Guess who jumped in? Warren Buffett, and bought $5 billion worth of GE, and bought $5 billion, I think, of Goldman Sachs. And he didn't get the Class A shares, folks. He didn't get the normal shares. He got his own special class of shares. Why? Because these companies were hurting for cash, and here he is sitting on tons of cash, and he says, oh, sure, but you got to pay me 10%, and you got to pay me the 10% before you pay anybody else. He had preferred shares, and oh, boy, couldn't Goldman Sachs get rid of those shares as best they could, and they had to pay him an extra $500 million just so they could buy the shares back from him. That's what it's like to be a contrarian. It ain't easy. Would you have done that in the midst of the worst crisis, the financial crisis since the Great Depression? It isn't easy. Exactly. So I like a contrarian personally strategy, but it's just not very easy to do. Now, here are three that I call dumb, dumber, and dumbest. So you think I'm biased against these? Right. Sector rotation. You supposedly buy stocks in the hot sectors and you sell the ones in the stale ones. But you have to decide what are the hot sectors out there and which ones are the stale ones. Momentum investing. You buy stocks as they go up, you sell stocks as they go down. And this often involves selling short, because remember we said that you can make money when the stock market goes down by selling short? And this is often called the greater fool theory. I love that name. Somebody out there is a greater fool than I am. And so I'm going to buy this stock knowing that it's really highly priced, assuming that somebody bids up the price higher, and then I can sell. Does this sound familiar? Right. This is what happened to houses in the mid-2000s. The prices just became detached from reality, knowing full well that these things, nobody could justify these prices, except that the price kept going up, so what do you care? It's great while the music is playing. I call it musical chairs. But as soon as the music stops, you better be sitting, right? And of course, a lot of people weren't, and they're still sitting on their houses that they bought in 2006 and 7 and underwater. Sometimes you hear people say, oh, I'm going to buy high and sell higher. Good luck. Good luck. And then the last one is market timing. Attempting to predict the future direction of the market. There's a great quote from a very famous money manager of the mid-20th century, Bernard Baruch. I love his name. Don't try to buy at the bottom and sell at the top. It can't be done except by liars. And often the people, they lie to themselves. These are the people who catch the big fish, it's this big, or a lot of times they have that gambler mentality. The gamblers will tell you about the one time that they made $4,000. I went to Vegas with $200 and came back with $4,000. They forget to tell you about all the other times they went with $200 and $500 and $1,000 and came back with nothing. Yeah, we fool ourselves. We'll discuss this much later on when we get to the psychology of investing. So, dear students, here are just some of investment strategies. Which strategy would you favor? Now, don't just say buy and hold because Mr. Piano says buy and hold, but think about these. Think about the way people invest, the different types of investors and traders and speculators, and think about which kind you would want to be. And what are the advantages of each, and what are the disadvantages of each? Because you're the expert now, right? Your family, your friends, your coworkers are going to want to know, well, what is this contrarian investing? Is it what you do? And you're going to say, well, I wish I could, but I'm not as good as Warren Buffett. Got it? Okay. Whoa. I'm proud of you because we have reached the end of Chapter 5. And yes, there's quite a bit of information in this chapter. You need to know it all. I am not kidding. I want you to go back over several times because in the next chapter, folks, oh boy, is this going to be so much fun. We are going to enter the inner temple of common stock valuations. I hope you're ready, and you'll get ready by studying Chapter 5 fiercely. Don't give up, folks. Never give up. Bring honor and glory and praise to Southwestern Community College and your family. Study hard.